Hey, yeah.
I have, a question and a point. So I'm wondering if, because there's an issue here with, you know, directionality, right? So,
yeah.
You know, presumably, English didn't start with, you know, 20-something cases and then become simple because it was spreading. It was sort of both of those things happening at the same time, right?
Yeah.
So can you do something by distinguishing between, like, polymorphism, you know, so variation within the language and variation
yeah.
between, so like a McDonald Crichton test or something of language, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but because, you know, if I think about, like, my own experiences with speaking English, it's like when I was in the East Coast where there's lots of trees and whatever, we said go right, go left, whatever. On the West Coast, you say go north, go south. So those are related to the environment, but
yeah.
things like calling it I-5 versus the 5 or something on the West Coast are not, they're just random.
Yeah.
Right? So there's something, it seems like, there. And then also, and how do you distinguish, or do you have, like, a species problem with languages? Like, how do you say something is a language versus a dialect? Because, you know, there's a lot of variation in that as well.
Yeah. So you absolutely have a species problem with languages. And, you know, there's really no reliable way. There's no kind of test because languages blend really one into the other. I get there are interesting parallels with species. So we are limiting our analyses to basically distinctions that other people have made, you know, and it doesn't really matter so much for the analysis whether you treat it discreetly or you allow a bit more continuity. But what you bring up about directionality is really key. So it's not the case that English is spreading because it's simple, right? People in general have no choice in what language they're learning. People are learning English because they need to learn English for economic reasons. There are also prestige sort of reasons. And so the prediction is that if Navajo had spread, right, then Navajo would undergo some of these same changes that English has. English, in particular, is a sort of an outlier in many respects because it started simplifying, and it did have grammatical gender, and it had cases, and it was much more similar to German. But it started the simplification process about 1,000 years ago. And English was essentially kind of became creolized because the British Isles were conquered by different populations. It was sort of a marginal language for a while. And so you do see some of this in recent history as English has spread. And actually, we're doing right now analyses within the language, so we can do analysis within both, say, American English by seeing whether people have different, sort of subtle differences in what they consider to be, you know, grammatical or okay to say, based on how much non-native English speech they heard growing up. Okay, and we're finding these differences within the language. And we can also do comparisons of nominally the same language, American English, British English, but American English in recent history has been more constrained by adult learners. It's been more shaped by non-native speakers than British English, although it's changing as the makeup of England is changing recently. And so we can see whether the ways in which they differ, now these differences are going to be fairly small, but we can see whether these differences are in the predicted directions, whether American English is sort of more regular and more productive and more compositional and so on. And so this is kind of a microevolution, if you will, of, you know, within nominally the same language. We can also look at, and people have done this before, but you can look at kind of case studies of, say, Latin spreading, you know, with the Roman Empire. And what you find is that Latin simplifies and all the Romance languages are simpler than Latin is, right? And so as Latin is learned by as the speaking community becomes more heterogeneous, there are certain systematic changes that are occurring. And so that speaks to the directionality issue as well. Yeah. Yes?
The mass comparison that you have there towards the simplification is very impressive. But I wonder, looking at it more retail, just a couple of examples if I can put. If we take the plural
yeah.
in three related languages, Arabic, which is the most widely spread of all, has an extremely complex plural system, whereas Hebrew is very simple, masculine, based on the masculine and feminine, and Amharic, which is pretty, you know, spoken by 30, 40 million people, has none whatsoever. Almost without plural. Secondly, what about Turkish? Would be down on the sort of agglutinating or polysynthetic side, and yet it must be very widespread. And third, just how does English, how does Frisian compare with English? Is Frisian, as the language I understand that is perhaps most closely related to English, has it, does it have complications that English doesn't? And let me just
So first up, the analyses we're doing are large-scale statistical analyses. There are many exceptions. Specifically, there are exceptions in particular systems. So it's not the case that, for instance, verb morphology and the plural system and grammatical gender are all perfectly correlated. And so you have many cases of, you know, languages displaying a huge amount of, you know, inflectional verb morphology but has no gender in the language, things like that. And so the plural case may be one of these. It's important to, the comparison of Hebrew and Arabic is a valid one, but it's in a parallel, kind of a parallel with biological evolution. Languages are constrained by their ancestors, right? So all Indo-European languages are much more similar to one another than they are to languages from a whole other family. And so the changes that are happening within Indo-European languages are systematic. But, you know, no amount of demographic pressure is going to sort of, you know, let them jump kind of to a whole different tree. So for example, we also find interesting differences between prefixing and suffixing. And there are reasons that one may be easier for kids than the other. But no European languages use inflectional prefixes, right? There's just zero variation. And so no amount of pressure, presumably, will introduce that prefixing. So I can imagine that the plural case, although, interestingly, I don't know how modern Hebrew differs from biblical Hebrew, but it would be interesting to look at in more detail because, of course, you have this case of the language being revived and learned as a non-native language by many people. And one can make predictions that this would lead to certain kind of, to nudge the language into particular directions. And the prediction would be in simplifying, making it more regular. But it still is Hebrew, so you can't sort of completely displace it. Yes?
The map of New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, was very impressive, and it makes me wonder if human populations have a tendency to maintain their identity by emphasizing and exaggerating their differences rather than blending and approaching each other.
Yes. So this is actually the term that someone has used, the skimogenesis of this kind of similar communities. Where's that map? Of introducing. Exaggerating the differences to mark their identity. This definitely seems to happen. So, for example, I, you know, naively thought, I think many people also have the same intuition, that with the advent of mass media, you would have just massive standardization and reduction of regional varieties. And to some degree, that's happened because people are moving around much more. But, you know, in the UK, people, all the varieties are there. It's not something that, you know, existed 100 years ago, kind of in the My Fair Lady days. And, you know, people are still extremely attuned to class differences, educational differences, regional differences, despite everyone watching the same TV. And so there is resistance to assimilation. People are marking their social identity, and With phonology in particular, it's interesting because it's hard to fake your accent. It's an honest signal, and people are, you know, to the degree of a colleague of mine has done these experiments where with kids where you pit racial differences against linguistic differences, so kids you know, if you give them a choice of who to take a toy from, they will go for someone who is more similar to them, someone who's of the same gender, for example. And so you can pit, you can, you know, have two kids offering them toys, kind of in videos, and one is the same race, and one speaks like them. And they go with who speaks like them, not the same race. So it's a very powerful kind of cue, social identity cue. And it's also flexible, right? So you can have someone who grew up in the South, moved to the Northeast and Midwest, doesn't really sound like they're from the South, but when they're back there, they take on that identity. So it's not always a fixed thing. Yeah.
I'm just curious about mechanisms. So using the evolution analogy, there are two ways you can get, you've got this very clear correlation between the number of speakers and the amount of non-native learning that's happening.
Yeah.
And simplicity. And in evolution, there are two drivers. One would be selection pressure, and one would be mutation pressure.
Yeah.
So mutation pressure in this case would be a tendency for not for the mutations, the changes in the language to arrive by an adult oversimplifying or underspecifying in the language,
right,
versus kids overspecifying. So I'm curious, versus selection, which would be this variance arises, but the adults don't learn it, it kind of goes away if it's too complicated. So my question is, is there evidence that there is a bias in the language mutations in adults versus children, and could be a driver as well, either instead of selection for the result?
Right. So it's unclear. You definitely have, I don't know if it's analogous to mutation, but so adults in learning a new language, of course, if they already speak a similar language, it makes a huge difference, but there are also similar ways in which adults fail in learning a new language. And informationally, you can imagine that, you know, it's a multidimensional space and they're just capturing the first few principal components. And so they're kind of trying to capture as much variation as possible with as simple a sort of rule as possible. And so they're getting it and then they plateau. They're not being sensitized to all the variation. And so it's easy to think about it in the grammatical case of, you know, they got the sort of rule that covers 80% of the cases, and they're just over-regularizing. But you also see it in learning words. So in general, adults are fantastic at learning new words, way better than kids. You know, you can't give a four-year-old a stack of flashcards and say, all right, learn these words, right? Whereas adults do this. But when it comes to actual usage, right, the kid will get the subtleties and the adult won't. And so you get this kind of blurring that's happening. And from the learning side, if what the child is hearing is this over-regularization, right, that's changing their input statistics, and so they will themselves be more likely to over-regularize. There is controversy in what kinds of changes kids bring into the language. If you give them sort of noisy input, they will kind of clean it up. There's a very interesting case of a study of native learning of Esperanto. So Esperanto was created to be perfectly regular, and there are people who are very passionate about Esperanto, and a group of kids who learned it as a native language. Their parents would speak Esperanto to them. They would also learn other languages as well. But you can look at what happened when kids learned it, and they mess it up. They introduce these subregularities, and they're not random. They are in a way making the language more functional, more useful, but they're messing up this, you know, mathematically clean system.
That sounds like mutation pressure.
Yeah, yeah. We've been I don't want to take up too much time, but looking to see how much can we explain through drift alone, whether how much selection pressure does one need. So the kind of explanation of why are there different languages, the default explanation is, well, there's drift. You can't have, in a community of a million people, not everyone will speak to everyone else, right? And so there are subpopulations and they drift and you get dialects. And so the question is, can we explain existing linguistic variation just through drift alone, And so we've been sort of modeling it in various ways. And so if you have a lot of drift, basically everyone ends up speaking their own language, essentially. And if you have no drift, then you know there's no variability, right? And so here's a case of drift alone, and here's drift with very mild selection. And so you basically get what start to look like language families, right? With just very, very mild selection, and increasing the selection pressure doesn't add a whole lot, but you go from just drift alone to drift with some selection pressure. And here it's implemented in a very simple way where depending on, there are four environments, and depending on which environment these agents find themselves in, there's a slight bias to prefer one kind of grammar over another. So we're implementing it at a very abstract level. Yes?
So I guess I have two questions. One was related to the first question about species of language. So on the whistle languages that you were referencing,
yeah,
I'm in my own mind of complexity, I'm trying to think, is would I consider this a species of language, or is it, in my mind, I'm thinking of it kind of as a proto-language, in that my guess is that people who use whistle language don't express the full range of experience, and
yeah,
they usually speak another language. So that's one question. The other is, in the question of complexity, I'm wondering how you see that interplaying with the question of geopolitical reality and the force of political power in the world, and the spread of language, and then the complexity that sometimes people, what we see as complex,
mm-hmm,
in a lot of words, for example, for something, speakers of the language may see as not complex at all, perfectly normal, and that, of course, you're being much clearer when you say over there, meaning that you're moving over there as opposed to, mm-hmm, a static over there. And so they're simplifying in another way where we, from our,
right,
little corner, think that that's more complex because they're adding something, but they think they're reducing something. So
right, right.
When in a political and species. And
right. So there's a saying of a language is a dialect with an army. Yeah, in real multilingual environments, you have blending. You know, it's really, if you just look at it bottom up, it's really hard to see the distinctions there. So, you know, the difference between Norwegian and Swedish is much, much smaller than between Mandarin and Cantonese. You know, those are called dialects. Norwegian and Swedish are called languages, right? So that's a political thing. I have some collaborators in Serbia, and after the breakup of Yugoslavia, you have, you see this where Serbian and Croatian are the same language. It used to be called Serbo-Croatian, but now people from Croatia are being forced to take language competency exams for entrance into a Serbian university,
mm-hmm,
right, and vice versa,
mm-hmm,
right? And they've now started using, so Serbian actually still uses both writing systems, Cyrillic and Roman, whereas Croatian abandoned the Cyrillic system altogether. So those are political things related to marking identity and kind of exaggerating differences that aren't really there, but you see yourself as a separate entity. For these analyses, it's not that important to really distinguish whether languages, so you can collapse, for instance, all languages from the same family together and say, okay, that's one data point, and I'm going to analyze it at that level. And so to analyze it kind of at a dialect level would be to go in the other direction and say, okay, I'm going to really look at these within language or within, you know, language type differences. So this kind of analysis is doing it at a certain level, analysis of comparison of American and British English, which you can say are sort of dialect differences. We can do it at that level as well. As far as complexity, it's, I think, impossible to define the total complexity of a language, because there are these and you can, so different formal ways of defining complexity, but there are these trade-offs, right? So you can minimize message length, but then you're maximizing the amount of sort of online encoding and decoding that has to happen. And so without appeal to psychological processes, it's impossible to say that language is this sort of level of complexity. But we can analyze it at a, for instance, at a surface level and say, okay, given that there are lexical ways of expressing something, just using different words, and there are grammatical ways of encoding what may or may not be the same distinction, but you know, roughly the same, what determines whether a language uses one or the other? And there are interesting differences in that if you express something lexically, it tends to be optional. Whereas if you express something grammatically, it tends to be obligatory. You have to make that distinction whether you care about it or not. You don't have a choice in English about omitting the past tense, even if you don't really care about tense, right? You can't omit number. You can't omit singular, plural. You have to specify. Whereas in Mandarin, you don't. And if it's important, you can say that it's two of something or three of something, but it's not grammatically marked. And so, there are these differences in, and this sort of relates to other research I do, kind of the abstraction that language allows. So it's always possible to become more specific, to elaborate, but you can't, language sort of constrains, the language you speak constrains in how abstract you can get. So as a very simple example, colors, different languages have different color terms. In English we have the word blue. In Russian, which I speak, there is синий, голубой, light blue, dark blue. You can say light blue, dark blue in English, no problem. You can't say blue in Russian. You can't say my favorite color is blue. There is no term that covers the whole range. If you say my favorite color is light blue and dark blue, it's as sort of silly as saying my favorite color is green and blue, right? It doesn't mean the same thing, and no one would say it. So you're forced to be more specific. You can be more specific in English, but you can't. So there's choice in this one direction, but not in the other. And so that has interesting consequences for the cognitive functions of language and these kind of differences. So,
and
yes.
Whistle language?
Oh, so the whistle language. So it's actually quite simple. It's a form of Spanish. So it's a transposition of Spanish sounds into whistles. And it's ambiguous because multiple sounds, Spanish phonemes, are collapsed into a single whistle. And so while you can have actual conversations, people only use it, as you said, in certain contexts. There are other kinds of similar systems, other whistle languages, also talking drums, where you use musical instruments as a kind of semaphore system to communicate messages rapidly, about an invading army. So this. And Europeans were trying to colonize Africa. They ran into this problem of messages of their arrival being very quickly transmitted by drums and a highly conventionalized code, a language of different drum tones, again mapping onto different phonemes of the language. And so you wouldn't just talk using it, but it has certain ceremonial functions and these sorts of for quick information propagation.
Quick question. Does a language whose population shrinks, does that then become more complex?
So that's a really good question. The prediction would be that yes, it would, and you can see it again on a small scale within a language, particular populations that often for political reasons may become marginalized and so they may still be speaking English, right? But the English, the dialect, it changes, and it changes in the direction of becoming more idiosyncratic, right? You're using not just words but constructions that sort of mark you as a member of that group. And in the process, it would take longer for these to be manifested as what you consider grammatical differences, but you do get this, it's, I'd say there aren't enough data.
So there are, you know, languages of populations that were larger in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, so in many of these cases, what happens is the population is shrinking because there aren't new speakers. And so the existing population is just dying off. I mean, the people are aging. And so any younger speakers aren't native speakers. And so they actually don't kind of speak the language in all of its kind of complexity and richness. They're not using it in their daily life. One would want to look at a population that's sort of that becomes cut off, and then but continues where the demographics, the age range, maintains that time. I don't know offhand of those cases.
Can non-human animals learn the whistling languages easier?
Well, non-human animals can't really learn.
Also, birds can learn language.
Well, not really. I mean, they're learning certain. They can be trained. They can be sensitized to particular statistical regularities that some languages have. It's not really, and bird songs contain syntactic complexity that one can say, you know, how does it compare to the syntactic complexity of the language? But it's not, they're not being used in you know, bird song is not language, even though some of the formal syntactic kind of structures can be compared to language. But the modality definitely matters. So in the animal language learning attempts, right, initially people thought, oh, you know, you can just talk to a gorilla. And you know, But gorillas, chimps, don't have the same innervation of their vocal apparatus. So they don't have voluntary control, the kind that humans do. But they have full voluntary control of their hands, right? And so, although the attempts aren't really successes as such, but any success that you see are in manual forms of communication, gesturing, not in anything vocal. Whereas with birds, so data that Irene Pepperbrook has from Alex and now a new parrot that she has, that's in the vocal domain, so parrots can learn to mimic human speech, and she's been trying to show that they're actually using it productively, and they can kind of, you know, count things and name shapes and so on. And there, it's in the vocal domain because they have voluntary control of their vocal apparatus, kind of that other primates don't. Yeah.
I feel like there's a dimension of the question of linguistic complexity that still is mysterious to me, and I don't know if anything you said maybe touches on this or not, which is how would a feature get started, like
yeah.
Some languages are tonal.
Right.
How could something like that get going? Because language depends on a whole bunch of people agreeing what things mean.
Yeah.
Or the clicks or the whistles, or how do these things get off the ground, so to speak?
Right. So the short answer is that no one knows. There's a biannual language evolution conference where I think there's actual progress being made. It's a fantastic conference, very interdisciplinary. But foundational questions like what is language for, you know, don't have unambiguous answers. What was it about the human lineage that led to the emergence of language? No other species has anything like language. There are no simple languages used in other species. There are some very complex communication systems, but they have core differences with human language. And if you human rear certain animals, they don't learn language, but they learn what, if we were to find that in the wild, we'd say, well, that's a mini language, right? And so they have the sort of latent capacities to learn that something that we would identify as a mini language, but they don't use it in the wild. My guess is that the difference is really one of social cognition, relating to pointing, kind of core theory of mind, where a language-like system doesn't make sense in a species that basically doesn't cooperate, doesn't share information, and that's sort of foundational. So pointing comes first. No other animal points. Even dogs that, you know, we bred to to follow points, and you have pointer dogs that point to us. Dogs don't point to each other. Chimps don't point, right? You can train them to follow points, but it doesn't happen in the wild. And so we don't know, there's no good answer why. With the case of tonal languages, you mentioned is, so there's some interesting evidence. A friend of mine, Dan Dedieu, published a paper in PNAS a few years back showing that controlling for a bunch of things, there are genetic differences in populations that have a higher likelihood of using a tonal language and ones that don't. And genes that, the function isn't obviously related to language, but there's evidence that they've been under recent selection. And so the idea is that when you have a difference like this, some languages use tones, others don't, a very, very small bias in either on the perception side or on the production side can basically fixate tone in the population. And so if that's true, if it's something like that, then the consequence is that it would be harder for some, just genetically, based on these genetic differences, and it's probabilistic, of course, it would be harder for some people to learn a tonal language than for other. So there now, they just got a grant to actually look at various aspects of vocal morphology and correlate it with phonological inventories, different languages. So this is Dan Dedieu and Steve Levinson at the Max Planck. They noticed that in some of their Aboriginal Australian field sites, you have languages that use very, very, they have very unusual consonants and consonant clusters, and the individuals have morphologically unusual throats. And so, again, a very small bias of it's easier for this population to produce certain, in this case, production, produce certain contrasts, certain consonants, can make it more likely and eventually fixate them in the population. And so that may explain how some of these differences arise as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.